I thought I'd start by giving a quick summary of where we're headed. So what I'm going to do first is to show that the topological quantum field theory of brains is in some sense exactly the same thing as the derived category of coherent sheaves, at least for B brains. And then the next thing I'm going to do is to go back to non-topological. And the question we'll ask when we go back to non-topological field theory is, are the D brains that we found in the topological field theory actually physical objects still? So this is going to get us onto the subject of stability. And then I'm going to describe four key examples. And that's where things get fun. And that also is hopefully, if you've been wondering why I've gone through all this horrible mumbo-jumbo of the derived category, these examples should hopefully convince you that you really have to go to the derived category or something similar if you want to understand the physics of B brains. Okay, so I'd also like to clarify one thing I mentioned right at the end yesterday. Even though I switch on these boundary maps to form a complex, I can still have two different D brains. So let this be a collection of sheaves, locally free sheaves, in the context I was talking about last time. And suppose each AN is actually a sum of two other sheaves, E and F. Then I can write, so what I did last time was a deformation of this theory. Like this. Now, if I do a general deformation, then what it means, I'm going to put general maps on these arrows here. Now, if I did that, I'd be mixing up both E and F. So what I want to do is to consider a less general deformation where my matrices here are going to be block diagonal of this form. So this is a deformation of the topological field theory, but it keeps the complexes E and F as two separate D brains. So this is what I'm going to mean by having two different D brains, even after I've done a deformation of the topological field theory to give myself a complex. So this really is two D brains. E is one of the D brains, and F is the other D brain. Okay. Now, the first thing I want to state is that actually this forms a category and the objects are the D brains. So an object in this category is a complex of locally free sheaves. It's a bounded complex of locally free sheaves because we insisted that only a finite number of the U's were non-zero. And the morphisms are the open strings. Now, I told you last time that the open strings lived in this hyper-X'd group, HOM P, E to F. Okay. So this is a morphism. I mean, there's a whole bunch of morphisms here going from E to F. Now, the composition of morphisms I claim is yep.
Does HOMP just
Well, I gave the definition yesterday. I'd have to think about what it was in the case of a point. I mean, the only interesting sheaves on a point are skyscrapers, which have no cohomology. So this is going to be fairly boring. You're probably only going to get HOM zeros because of the lack of cohomology of a point. With more interesting cohomology, this gets more interesting. If I just had a skyscraper sheaf as E and a skyscraper sheaf as F, then the only thing would be HOM zero. So that's all I'd have for points. It'd be fairly trivial. The derived category of current sheaves of a point isn't, well, I haven't got to the derived category yet, but I will soon. But a point isn't very interesting.
Did you call it X yesterday?
No, I think I called it HOM yesterday. What did I call it, X?
You called it HOM.
I called it HOM, yeah, but some people call it X. I mean, whether you call it HOM or X is differs from book to book. Yeah, that is the set of all morphisms form a vector space between any two objects. You take a pair of objects, there's an infinite number of morphisms, and those then that infinite number of morphisms forms a vector space, which is Z graded, which is it. Yeah, that's right. And the composition is given by the Yonuda pairing. So there is a natural map from HOM P E F HOM Q F G to HOM P plus Q. So here's the grading on the, it's actually E to G. And this is actually nothing other than the operator product for open strings. And this is what's nice about the B model. The B model doesn't suffer from any quantum corrections. So what you classically think of as the operator product algebra is actually going to be the real operator product algebra. So the operator product is classically what you'd expect it to be in this context. This is what's going to go horribly wrong for the case of the other topological field theory at the A brains. In the A brains, I'm going to have a horrible operator product because there are Wilczek instanton corrections. So that's why A brains are much, much worse. Now, let T of X be the category of all topological B brains. I mean, this is a minor point, but a topological field theory that I've considered so far was a finite number of D brains. I just choose a finite number of D brains and consider the topological field theory on that. I now want to write down the thing Tx, which is going to take all possible brains. So this is the sum of all possible topological field theories of B brains. Any given topological field theory is going to be a full subcategory. So any of the topological field theories I consider is a full subcategory of Tx. Okay. With a finite number of objects, unlike Tx, which has an infinite number of objects. Now, clearly there is a functor. Let me call it F K B L F X to X. Well, this is the category of bounded complexes of locally free sheaves. And, I mean, by construction, I discovered that my objects were complexes of locally free sheaves. A morphism in this thing here is going to be a chain map, but a chain map is nothing other than a thing in HOM zero. If you work out what HOM zero is, you'll find that that is indeed chain maps. Oh yeah, got my had a type mismatch. I'm not sure. I'd have to go through the details. See, I was saying even for locally free sheaves, there are morphisms which exist which can't be written in terms of the bundles. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to go to the. Yeah. I'm sure I can work this out, but I'm not sure if I could answer it sensibly now, because I'm going to go to the category of coherent sheaves soon. The next thing we have to ask is, when are two D-brains different? I mean, the essential content of a topological field theory is nothing other than the operator product algebra. So if you give me two D-brains, if you give me two complexes, and I can't distinguish between them using the topological field theory, I'm going to claim that they represent exactly the same D-brain. So suppose E1 and E2 are two complexes such that HOM P E1 F is HOM P E2 F and HOM P F E2 equals HOM P F E1, I suppose. Let's call that E1. For all F and P. Yeah, this is always F dot. If that's true for all F dot and P, I claim that the two complexes, E1 and E2, must represent physically the same D-brain. The topological field theory cannot distinguish between those two objects. Well, let's say isomorphic in this category TX. Sorry? Because I'm just taking the kind of axiom, if you like, that the content of a topological field theory is the operator product algebra. Well, that actually follows. That's going to take care of itself, I claim. The operator product is defined kind of, I mean, naturally in the same way for the complexes as for the topological field theory. So, I mean, the operator product is going to work out fine. There's a natural. I'm not sure if I'm saying this very well. There's. I claim it does, even though I'm not going through the details.
And I agree, you could expect two different types in the same vector.
Exactly. I'm trying to rack my brain to remember the details of this. I didn't write it in my notes, and I went through it a couple of months ago in detail. I'd have to think about it, but I did manage to convince myself that the operator product algebra will take care of itself. Because there's a very natural... Yeah, well, let me skip that point, and we can worry about it later if you want.
Automorphism? I mean, to identify these, you have to choose a map, I presume, from V1 to V2 in such a way that the hums are isomorphic. At least we have to pick an isomorphism between those hums.
Yeah.
So you're claiming we can choose an isomorphism.
Right, right. Absolutely, right.
But we might be able to change the isomorphism.
Yeah, I can remember worrying about exactly this problem a couple of months ago, and I can't remember. It's a bit too early in the morning for me to remember exactly how I got out of it. Right, I claim that if this is true, then the OPE is also going to be the same. So at the moment, I'm just claiming that there's an isomorphism of groups, but I'm claiming that this does extend to the ring structure. Now, if we accept this, then this functor takes quasi-isomorphisms. I'll explain what those are. To isomorphisms. Okay. So what's a quasi-isomorphism? Well, if I have two So here's one chain. And a quasi-isomorphism is a chain map. We call it a phi. Where phi acts, well, phi induces an isomorphism from the cohomology of the upper complex to the cohomology of the lower complex. So I leave it as an exercise in homological algebra to show that if such a quasi-isomorphism takes this chain to this chain, then these groups are going to be the same. Perhaps what I should have done is to say that I'm going to say that the two D brains are the same if there exists a map between the chains which induces this isomorphism. And then that gets me out of the problem. Okay, yeah. So, if we ignore subtleties of locally free versus coherent sheaves, then there exists a functor, what do I call it, G, that takes me from D of X to T of X where d of x is the derived category of x. And if you don't know what the derived category of x is, you can take this as a definition. The derived category is the universal category such that for every functor from the category of complexes to a given category, if that functor takes quasi-isomorphism to isomorphisms, then there must exist a functor that takes dx to tx. It's a weird definition of dx, but it's a plausible way of writing down what it is. Pardon? Well, the problem with the derived category is that it's the derived category of coherent sheaves, and up to now I've been talking about locally free sheaves. Right. So yeah, I mean, I'm going to mention soon, it doesn't matter, but you might worry that I've suddenly jumped to a derived category of coherent sheaves when everything up to now was locally free. And I should add that this derived category is bounded. All my derived category is going to be bounded because I had bounded chain complexes.
So when we started the debranding of vector,
right.
Then you motivated because of these definitions, we should look at chain complexes.
Right.
But it seems that going to coherent sheaves, physically that should mean something. For example, vector bone was supported on the subject.
Well, I claim it's not going to matter. I mean, this is what I was going to say in 5 minutes. I was going to say it now because any coherent sheaf has a locally free resolution in terms of locally free sheaves. So since I've gone to considering complexes, I can replace any complex of coherent sheaves with locally free sheaves.
Up to
quasi-isomorphism, which I've modded out by. Right. That's. Oh, right. Well, for the for the definition of the quasi-isomorphism, I need to go to the coherent sheaves because the cohomology doesn't exist just in locally free sheaves. So I implicitly use it in this statement here.
It does if you restrict morphisms to the bundle maps.
Okay. So I guess I didn't then. Yeah, that's the slightly awkward point that I do seem to have extended to maps between sheaves, which might not have been induced by vector bundles.
Which I think are a natural deformation of bundle maps.
Okay.
Anyway, right?
Okay.
Because the point is that a bundle map requires that the matrix which describes the map between the bundles is a constant rank over the entire space.
Yeah.
And if you specialize to certain points, then it cannot be.
Okay, right. Fair. So, finally, let's consider T0 of X to be the subcategory of TX, consisting only of morphisms from 0 e to f. Okay, so all I'm doing is fairly trivial. I'm just taking all the morphisms which are Hom P, and I'm just going to talk about morphisms Hom 0. That forms a consistent subcategory of T. Then it is not hard to show that G0, there's a natural restriction then of this functor G. This is full, faithful, and dense. That's actually quite easy. In other words, this is an equivalence of the functors, i.e. an equivalence of functors. Ruth. Dense is that it's subjective on objects. Full and faithful means that there's an isomorphism between the set of morphisms for any fixed pair of objects. So I've shown, therefore, that T0 is exactly the same thing as D of X. That this restriction of the category of all topological field theories is the same thing as the derived category. Now, I'm going to claim that actually T0 is pretty much the same thing as T. So, restricting Tx to T0 is actually gives no loss information. And the reason for this is let square brackets n be an operator on complexes that shift 10 places left. Okay, so that's an easy thing. You take a complex, I can then put this brackets n on the complex, and all it does is shift my complex n places left. In other words, if I have a complex k and I shift it n places left, then the ith element of that is just equal to k n plus I. Then, Hom P of E F is nothing other than Hom 0 of E F dot shifted by n. I find it so strange not to write n in the brackets now. So actually, all of my Homs are actually in Hom 0. So T0 is actually the same thing as T.
The difference between the symbols, if I have two morphisms, two complexes,
yeah,
one in Hom T and one in Hom Q, okay, the difference between T and Q cannot be shifted away. I can shift P to 0 by your operation, or I can shift Q to 0. I can't shift both of them to 0 at the same time.
Right, but the point is given any morphism between two D brains, I can turn it into a degree zero morphism by changing one of the D brains.
That's right.
That's all I'm saying.
Two morphisms between the same D brains.
Right, if I have two different morphisms, then I certainly can't make them the same.
One to zero.
Sure.
From zero, I can
absolutely.
Together,
I'm not saying that the all Homs are Hom zero. What I'm saying is that the category, or the essential content of the category on T0 is the same thing as T.
You're losing your Z-gradient.
Right. So, formally what I've proven is that the equivalence of is between dx and T0, but I'm saying that, morally speaking, I may as well think of T0 and T at the same time. Any physical question in Tx I can ask in T0 of x. The information content is the same. The derived category, by definition, comes from chain maps, which are the degree zero things. They're the Hom zero things.
It's just different between category and the category.
Right.
The T0 is a category that is called canonical condition,
okay? Okay. Right. I did it backwards. I took the graded thing, which was T, and turned it into the non-graded thing, T0. Okay. So let me just mention briefly what I already said again, that actually complexes of coherent sheaves are the same thing as complexes of locally free sheaves. Up to quasi-isomorphism, which is what we've modded out by anyway. So I claim I can do this jump from locally free sheaves to coherent sheaves. And if you like, this is a kind of a proof that deep brains are associated to coherent sheaves. Which is how I've got, for example, my complex submanifolds rather than the total space into the picture. I can think of a coherent sheaf as being like a vector bundle that only lives over some subspace. That is an example of a coherent sheaf. That was the thing that I explicitly did not include when I wrote down Witten's B model. But I've actually managed to get them for free because any such object, any such vector bundle over subspace can now be written as a complex of locally free sheaves, which I did include.
In the category of complexes of coherent
sheaves. Right. No, but I'm saying that any complex of coherent sheaves can be rewritten as a complex of locally free sheaves.
Yeah, that's right. There's a quasi-isomorphic
right.
which is a complex of locally free sheaves.
So if I did it for locally free sheaves, I get exactly the same thing as if I did it for coherent sheaves. So there's no essential difference at this stage. Right.
But you're already in the category of coherent sheaves.
I didn't know.
Otherwise, the statement couldn't make any sense. And I mean, physically, that's the right thing, because physically, you had holomorphic submanifolds, and you could have put vector bundles on them.
I disagree with what you're saying, but I never had to go to the coherent sheaves at any stage of the construction. I've managed to get it for free. There was no point where you forced me to go to the coherent sheaf.
I think the question,
so
the
morphemes that you have, it's meant in bundles. Yeah, except for that issue.
The constant time or anything like that. They're just, maps linear
right.
in part. So just the same maps as in the category of coherent sheaves.
Right. Right. Right, that's all I'm saying. Well, in injective resolution, I need to go to quasi-coherent sheaves anyway. So I mean, that's going even bigger. So I don't want to get to say that. Yeah. Right. Okay. So. Just one last step before we can go to non-topological field theories. suppose I try to deform again. So I've got my topological field theory. I'm going to try and play the same trick as last time. I take all ghost number one operators and try and use those as marginal operators. So the ghost number one operators are... Well, the ghost number was just P. So it's HOM of 1 E to F. Well, as I said, I can write this as HOM 0 of E F shifted by 1, or HOM 0 of E shifted by minus 1 to F. So let me take two deep brains. (Clears and let me write an element of this. It's going to be, it's like a chain map, but it's going one place to the right. Then all that chain map, when I turn this chain map on, what it does is it gives me another chain complex. Well, now these maps are DE0 phi DF. So these are all phis. DE0 phi. Yeah. So it just gives me another chain complex. This is another chain complex. And actually, this complex has a name. It's called the mapping cone. the way I've done it, there's a shift of one here, which is not present in the mapping cone. So I'm going to have to call it minus one. This shift of one is going to drive us crazy when we go to whether things are stable by mixing up whether things are brains or anti-brains. But, so let me make sure I get it right. There's got to be a minus one there at the moment. But the mapping cone, well, obviously it's a complex. It's already in the derived category. So this deformation hasn't taken me out of the derived category. It's just I've just stayed inside. If I switch on a map between two different D brains, it's as if I combine those two D brains into yet another complex.
Can you say again,
we're deforming the topological field theory, which consisted of various brains, including E and F. It's exactly the same trick as I used to build this in the first place. I take a topological field theory, I look for ghost number one operators, and I use those as deformations of the theory.
So before you start to degrade the trees and to make them complex.
Right. Right. And now I try again and I don't get anything new. I just get more complexes. So this actually shows, if you cast your mind back, there were some exts earlier. Which I ignored. I had things like x2 of en minus 1. And if you remember, I chose not to turn those exts on. But those exts can be written in terms of the derived category as this kind of thing. So I claim that those other exts, aren't going to give me anything other than what I've already got. I can turn on as many exts as I want, x0s, x1s, x2s, x3s, x4s. I'm not going to get anything other than the derived thing dx at this point. Okay. So it looks as if I've got, at least in some sense, the most general thing I can find. Now let me note that there's some interesting work by Jackanescu, which is based on some work by Lazariu, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, which implies that perhaps I haven't got the most general thing I could write down. They go kind of off shell to get something even bigger. So I've got something which is pretty general. It's possible I haven't written the most general thing down. But I've certainly got something which is the most general thing I can find by looking at deformations of the topological field theory that I started with ghost number one operators. Okay. So for my talk, this is the most general thing I can get. So that's everything that I'd want to know about the topological theory. I've got that it's the derived category. The information content of the derived category is the same as a topological field theory. The operator product algebra is the algebra of morphisms in the derived category. So I've got pretty much all I want, I think.
Is there one observation? If we think about vector bundles of some manifold, my feeling is that in some sense, we don't know physically that the vector bundle is over a sub-manifold. We find the equivalent topological field theory to a gradient relief. So the arguments so far don't show that, in fact, the vector topological field theory found by vector bundle of sub-manifold is equivalent to a gradient relief. As we start to locally reach this formula, we get new topological field theory.
Well, this is my definition of what a topological field theory on a submanifold is.
I can now define a consistent topological field theory based on a vector bundle of some manifold.
Yeah, but if it's not the same as mine, that, well, I'm saying to, it's different.
It's the same as yours.
Right. Well, my definition of topological field theory was based on Witten's B model for the locally free case. And now I'm defining this, and then I'm just using that definition to define what I mean by a submanifold.
Yeah, but we can define the Witten's B model.
Right. Well, what you're saying is going to be very odd when I come to stable bundles, because I'm literally going to start playing with some physical D4 brains. So what you're going to tell me is that what I'm going to claim about physical D4 brains might not be true.
No, this is true. If you're saying just follow the logic, it's not quite...
Okay, well, as I said, my logic is that this is my definition of what a D brain on a submanifold is.
If I have a D4 brain on the divisor, and you define it, you say two-term.
Right. That's my definition.
It's not clear that that's right.
Okay, but I'm assuming that it is.
Yeah.
Okay. So, now we go to the issue of stability of D-brains back in a non-topological field. I mean, let's think exactly what we've described by going to the topological field theory. What I'm claiming is that, the way we built things, we only looked at sets of D-brains which preserved space-time supersymmetry. Now, a simple example of a collection of D-brains which preserve space-time supersymmetry is one D-brain by itself. So one D-brain, hopefully, I can describe in in terms of the topological field theory which I wrote down. Now, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everything that I found in the topological field theory is something which came from a true physical object in the untwisted theory. And I'll find out, and I'll find that my that DX contains way too many objects. It is true that it is hopefully true that a physical D brain by itself does correspond to an object in DX, but the converse is certainly not true. So I want to find out which of the things in DX can be thought of as a good D brain in the untwisted theory, and the. Sorry? It exists. Well, I'm going to just address the question of whether it's stable.
Okay. I've talked about lots of things that exist that are not stable.
Right. So I'm going to just look at things which are stable here. Okay. That's going to be my criterion. Yeah, okay. It's going to be stable. So since you heard lots of things about things being stable last week, I don't need to go into too much detail, but a BPS state has a central charge, I'll call Z, where the mass of the BPS object, if you choose a normalization, right, is the mod of Z. This is a complex number. Okay. Now, if we have a decay of solitons, into a set of other BPS objects, then Z is conserved. So the total Z is equal to the sum of all the little Zs. But this implies that the magnitude of that is less than, use the Schwarz inequality. which means that the that the mass of the thing we started with has to be less than the mass of the less than or equal, has to be less than or equal to the mass of the things that we decay into. Well, they can't possibly be less than it because of conservation of energy. So the best thing we can do is to use the equal sign here. Sorry? Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah. Right. What? I did it right. 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 This is the implies. For it to physically happen, it would have to be greater than or equal to. Therefore, the only thing that can happen is that it's. Right, so if I had more energy to begin with, I could have radiated stuff off. But I can't, because this tells me that... No, but I'm talking about a decay of an object. I've got an object in its ground state with no other energy around. It can't possibly decay into a set of things which have more energy than what I started with. Yeah. So the best we can do is have a marginal decay. Where we have the equal sign here, which implies that the arguments of all these complex numbers are the same. Okay. So what typically happens is this, which so I've got a moduli space of all theories, say. So I'm going to vary something. In our case of B brains, I'm going to vary B plus IJ. And what I have is, if I'm over here in the moduli space, I have some BPS object A, which exists. And then I move in the moduli space, and I hit some kind of wall in the moduli space. And A turns into two other objects which exist, called B and C. So A exists as a BPS object on this side of the line. B and C exist as BPS objects on the other side of the line. And this line is the line of marginal stability where all three objects, A, B, and C, are stable they all exist at the same time as BPS objects. This is going to be a line of real codimension one subspace. And it's precisely on this line of these things being marginally stable that this is true, that the argument of A and B are going to be equal. Sorry, the argument of B and C are going to be equal and hence equal to A. So we're going to use this picture to see if these D brains that we've got are actually stable.
So suppose I found a line of marginal stability where arguments of C are overlapped.
Yeah.
Then the
not necessarily, but I'm going to argue that at least in some cases it does follow that the thing will actually decay. At least in some examples where I'm going to talk about. That's why I said what typically happens. I'm not claiming that this has to happen. I'm going to explain it more soon. now. I told you I'm going to exploit A-brains and not prove anything about them. It can be shown that for an A-brain, this central charge is nothing other than the integral of the holomorphic three form over that slag. Okay. One of the ways you can see that this is kind of working is that you can think of a D-brain as having a kind of a fixed tension. So the mass of a D-brain must be given by the volume of the thing that it's stretching over. And indeed, the modulus of this complex number is indeed the volume. So it's a reasonable assertion. Of course, I want the phase, so I should really explain where we got the phase, but I'm not going to. So, if you remember, the phase of this integral was exactly what I used earlier to motivate this notion of grading. Remember, I had two subspaces. I'm not sure if I used exactly the notation I'll use now. I had E of one thing, psi of one thing, psi of this thing, and if I had an open string, then I had psi of phi, where psi is equal to 1 over pi times the argument, and psi of the open string is simply psi of oriented string, where it's going minus psi of where it's leaving. So these psi's which we use as a grading are actually exactly the same thing as the phase of the central charge. Pardon? Phi is the phi is the open string which is going from here to here. I'm just saying that given a string phi, I compute the grading psi by this formula here. Yeah. Right. Plus something. Plus the grading that I get intrinsically from the topological field theory. Because remember, this was the P, this was M, and this was N. So there is something else that I can get from the string itself. Okay. I always omit that. So now I want to do Sen's tachyon condensate. And what's going on here? So I've got two brains. I've got a open string I'll call phi. Now I'm going to make this. This is where it's easy to get. This is an anti-D brain, and this is a D brain. One of the things that can drive you crazy at this point is getting mixed up between brains and anti-brains. If I have an anti-brain at one end and a brain at the other end, then a conformal field theory argument shows that the mass squared of this open string is equal to yes. And I guess this is for the case where P is zero. I have no idea what units I'm using. With some use. Yeah, I mean I've got alpha primes and all. Yeah. Yeah. there's probably a string. Oh no, I guess. No, this is all conformal field three, so I shouldn't have string coupling error.
So I think there's an alpha quantum on the left.
Sure.
Now I have a question. So if we got
energy,
we got string scale energy. Why are you allowed to use moduli space arguments from holomorphy and kind of BPS arguments that you're using when you've got tachyons on the scale, when you've got string scale tachyons around? Why are you allowed to use all this beautiful holomorphic geometry? When we should be using whole string geometry when we have analyzed the problem.
Well, I'm certainly setting the string coupling to zero in everything I'm saying. Will you let me?
No.
I think this is where I'm going to be safe. For everything I'm going to say, this mass squared is going to be very close to zero. This difference is everything I'm going to mention. The difference between these two numbers is going to be very close to one. Yeah. For the only bits of the moduli space I'm ever going to talk about, will be the places where the D-brains are marginally stable, and that's when this is equal to 1. So all the questions I'm going to address,
you're going to tell me that the analysis will be valid in some scaling region.
Yeah, I'm certainly going to keep these masses very, very, very small. Okay, yeah. Now, I realized at this point when I was writing my notes that I had an insidious sign problem, which I'm going to fix by doing that. I'm not quite sure where the sign problem came from, but I'm going to declare that psi is minus 1 over pi times the argument from now on. Well, as I said, I think I'm just making this assertion when p is zero, so it's the same thing. so the idea is that if m squared is less than zero, then phi is a tachyon which will stick A and B, E and F together. So my notes say A and B when I'm writing E and F, so I might get a little bit confused. And what I'll roughly have, now what I'm about to write down isn't true, but it's a way of thinking about it. I have some kind of an exact sequence where E and F are going to get stuck together, and I make G. So G is stable. Now, when this mass goes to zero, that's going to be the case where things are marginally stable, when I don't gain or lose any energy by sticking E and F together to make G. And when the mass squared is bigger than 1, that's going to be where G is unstable. I'm going to go through this in detail soon, if you're worried about how to define the central charge in terms of chain characters. So just hold off a second, I'll get to it. So if m is zero, we have the marginal case. And if m squared is bigger than zero, we have the unstable case. So this is what's supposed to happen in our moduli space. Somehow, C, F minus E. So that's how this line of marginal stability is going to be found.
So B and C are even after
G is A? Yeah. And as I said, E is really an anti-D brain, not a brain. Now, I told you how to compute what the central charge was for an A brain. What we want to do is run this story for B brains. So how do I compute the central charge of a B brain? So the claim is the following. So my B brain is an object in the derived category. it's in different order to my notes. Plus quantum correction. So that's what my claim is going to be. Now, first of all, note that the Chern character for an object in the derived category is well defined and easy to calculate. All I do is take the alternating sum of the Chern characters of the things in the complex. And it's minus infinity to infinity. So I can certainly compute this for any objects in a derived category. And this is going to be what my central charge will be. Now, I'm not honestly sure of the best way of proving this. There's The quantum corrections, I mean, are going to be things to do with alpha prime. I'll mention more explicitly exactly what these are. I'm going to need to know in detail exactly where these things are coming from. Yeah, right.
Is there some formula for this direction?
Well, I'm going to tell you exactly how we're going to find these periods. I'm going to find an exact way of determining what these periods are in any example. Probably, yeah. Yeah, I suspect for any full supersymmetry and higher, then this is going to be exact. Yeah, I think that has to be true. Yeah. Now, sadly, I don't have enough time to prove this. one of the ways is to do with anomaly inflow arguments. And basically, there are kind of two steps to proving this. First of all, I need to prove that this thing somehow represents the D brain charge, and then I've got to show that the central charge then is given by the D brain charge if I multiply by this. So there's work done by Will you be mentioning this, Greg? Are you okay? That's said. Manazian and Moore. Freedom, Witten, etc. So there's various arguments which would take me way off on a tangent where I don't want to go. So I'm just going to claim that this is true. Sorry? I'm sorry? Okay, Trang and Yen. I don't know how to spell their names. So. The quantum corrections, you know, have to be there because these periods will not satisfy the Picard-Fuchs equation, right, as I'm about to say. So we know that this cannot be an exact statement. No, I don't believe that there is. Okay. So, I'm going to do some examples later, where I'm going to actually determine the exact form of the period. I'm going to work out what the quantum corrections are, and I'm going to be able to do that because of mirror symmetry. The formula that I wrote down for the A brain of the integral of the holomorphic 3 form is believed to be exact. So I can use mirror symmetry between A brains and B brains to deduce what this will be. And I'll do an exact computation in an example later on. But let me do some examples first of all where I don't need to worry about the quantum corrections. So I'm going to do it by making the Kähler form very, very large, and let's see what happens. So what I'm going to describe is a notion of what's first called pi stability in a paper by Douglas, Thiel, and Remmelsberger. So we want the derived category version. Of A plus B makes C. But I actually told you exactly how to do that earlier. Let me use A, B, and C for the time being, otherwise I'll go insane. But we saw that an open string makes a D-brain in the marginal case. You see, all the topological field theory knows about is the case when this difference is 1. It's exactly on this line where things are marginally stable that I've got unbroken space-time supersymmetry, and therefore I can use my topological field theory. So, along this line, I can go back to my topological field theory. I can ask for a map that's going between one D-brain and another. The grade of the map is 1, which, as I mentioned earlier, that was my deformation of the topological field theory. That was the ghost number 1 deformation. Here is the grade number 1 open string. And I found when I used that deformation, I got the mapping cone from A to B. So this is an object in the derived category, this is another object, this is the thing that I get when I use that deformation to deform the two complexes into one complex. So this is the derived category version of one D-brain, of two D-brains combining into one D-brain in a marginally stable way. Now, here's where we have to delve into a bit more abstract nonsense. Now, cones in the derived category are closely related to things called distinguished triangles.
Thank you.
Right. So, well, no, not an exact sequence. I'm going to say there's a distinguished triangle. But yes, that's true so long as we're on the line of marginal stability.
Charges.
Absolutely. And if I have.
I think that the output state has to be the output charge has to be the sum of the input.
And it is absolutely true that the churn class of a mapping cone is equal to the sum of the churn. So that the churn character of the mapping cone is equal to the sum of the churn characters of the two categories that you're. Of the two objects that you're mapping between. So it works perfectly. I was about to state that, so again. So, in particular, you see, the problem with the derived category is that there are no such thing as short exact sequences. I'm not allowed to write down a short exact sequence of things in the derived category, because the derived category has no notion of a sub-object. I can't say that some object is a sub-object of some other object, which is what makes this fun. All I can do is do something like this. I can say that there's, and think of this as the analog of a long exact sequence that you get from a short exact sequence. So my short exact sequence is going to be A going to B going to cone. Then I complete this by another map which takes me back in a triangle, but this map that goes back is a shift left by one. Okay? So this is a long exact sequence where this is the boundary map that takes the degree of the cohomology up by one, if you like. Now, I can shift things a little bit. I can replace A minus one by A. If I move my one shift there, okay, that's just a trivial shift of this one place right. That's going to move where the one jump is. And as I just mentioned to Greg, the churn character of the cone of phi, in this case, is equal to the churn character of A plus the churn character of B. I suppose I should have dots on all of these. These are all complexes. There's a what? There's a what?
Turn of
B dot plus 1. No. I've only shifted A, which is why, so both of these maps have to shift by 1. That's gone down by 1, that's gone up by 1. So this is right. So, let me just say again, if psi of B minus psi of A equals 1, which is going to be the case we always have in the topological field theory for a mapping cone, this is marginal. If psi of B minus psi of A is less than 1, then the cone of phi is stable. And if psi of B minus psi of A is bigger than 1, the cone is unstable. Yeah. This is now, the original version of pi stability wasn't defined in terms of distinguished triangles, but the idea of looking at phases was the. Yeah. That it is energetically favorable, if you like, to have A and B rather than to have the cone. If it's marginal, I can have both A and B and the cone. If it's less than 1, then I would rather have the cone than have A and B. If it's bigger than 1, I'd rather have A and B than the cone. Well, Pretty much, because I'm assuming that the mass of the open string that was binding these two things together was a tachyon, and now it's going to have positive mass. So long as when I cross, the sign of this is changing. I mean, it's possible that two lines might go together. So it's only going to happen then. But if it's a first order kind of effect, then yes.
You talk about the size of DNA are geometric frames, so on, but you didn't define them.
Yeah, psi is minus 1 over pi times the argument of z. But it's the thing that doesn't live on a circle, it lives on the real line. I've got to follow exactly what... Now, this is going to become quite clear probably on Thursday's talk, when I'm going to give an example where I'm going to have to follow this outside the region 0 going to 2. But that's what Xi is going to be. Yeah.
But even when you follow it outside, it's still 1 that's important, isn't
it? Yeah, it is 1 that's important.
And thus, even though you drop that P at some point,
That P I've kind of got back into the story. The P is incorporated in the grading here. I was just being sloppy for that moment when I was writing down that diagram. This is all going to work. Well, no. What I'm saying is that. I mean, that's what I was going to emphasize this time. that whenever I have a distinguished triangle, now, one thing you've got to remember about a distinguished triangle is that there's not really a favored vertex. I've decided to call one of the vertices the cone, and I've looked at it in terms of a decay into another two things. So the way you've got to picture this is as follows. For any distinguished triangle in a derived category, if the relative grade of two objects on one side is bigger than or less than one, it tells you whether the opposite vertex is stable or unstable. That's going to be the way it works. So this is true for any distinguished triangle, because any distinguished triangle in a derived category can be written in terms of a mapping cone and vice versa.
No, but if there are objects in the derived category in many different distinguished triangles.
Right, so you have to look at all of them. Well, this tells you just whether it's unstable. If it's to prove it's really stable, you've got to check every possible thing that it might think of turning into. So you've got to look at every distinguished triangle where that object is a vertex.
So if I have an electric charge 1, and I can write it as 138 positive
charges, I don't understand the question. Well, there's a subtlety. I'm not sure if I'm going to answer your question, but there was a subtlety that I was about to say, which is what makes this difficult. Right. That's true. Now, what you've got to be very careful about this is that I've assumed that the things I'm decaying into are stable. This is where this gets very confusing, is that if for some reason the things I'm decaying into are not stable, then this whole argument's going to break down.
They
might not be there as BPS states, which is what can make this awkward.
You have to make sure.
Right, well, the reason why there's a slight lack of symmetry is that one of these vertices has to be the plus one shift. Right, and that then fixes this
sign.
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm going to give some examples where I'm going to claim that some things are stable and unstable, but I'm just going to just check one triangle. So. Right. Absolutely, right. This is what's fun about the derived category, is that no vertex is favored. So I can't think of some big BPS object, which is somehow the master BPS object that has all the sub-objects in it. I can't say anything is a sub-object of anything else.
Yeah,
Yep.
But, I mean, if it is darkness, so for your chief at large gradient, then I understand you still have like some notion of it, like something that you can do.
I'm going to do that next.
Math estimate, but now, I mean, now you go to Levi's gradient, you would use your notion of like kernels and co-kernels, and let's say you go to completely different point in Taylor modulus, right?
I'm going to do this. The very first application I'm going to do is to get back the classical notion of a vector bundle being stable. Well, splitting into two objects is like splitting into two and then two again. Right. Yeah. So there's no real. Well, all marginally stable. Yeah. I just want them to exist at the moment that I decay into them. Okay. I don't believe they'll fill up the tank. Right. See, that's exactly the problem of making sure that the things you decay into are stable. If I didn't put that condition in, I think it would be dense. It's the fact that the two things I decay into have to be stable is what stops it being dense.
Yeah, that contributes your answer to the three body decay.
No, but they're either stable or marginally stable.
Yeah, I know, but
they exist.
It may not be true that, let's say that A is supposed to decay with the D plus D, right? Now, indeed, there might be a place in the moduli space where D plus C is marginally stable. Some other object E, right? So then, but that need not necessarily be the same place where A is marginally stable to decay into E plus E. Right? So you can't.
Then it won't happen. I mean, I've got to have some process by which I can go through.
Body decay at some. I mean, the
only way that they are the only way that the central charge of the big object is lines up properly with the other central charges is if the arguments are the same for every one of them.
Yeah.
So the marginal lines have to have crossed. So I've got to have the possibility of just looking at a subset of the decay to find my various codimension ones things, and then where they cross, that's where the more than two case can happen. That's the only way it can work with the phase of these complex numbers.
I actually want to make one comment. It seems to me, I don't know the details, but it seems to me that some light on all this could be shed by studying basins of attraction on attractive ones.
Right. I mean, that might well be an interesting point. Yeah, right. now, I've got, in the last 10 minutes, I think I've got just about enough time to do what I think is a really nice observation by Douglas, Fjell, and Remmelsberger, is that I'm actually going to be able to deduce in the large radius limit that things being stable as BPS states is actually the same thing as saying that vector bundles are stable. So this is my... I mentioned at the start I'm going to do four key cases. This is case one. So this is boring old vector bundle. So my computation essential charge is e to the b plus ij times the chain character of my bundle. I'm going to call it F, times the square root of the Todd class. Where J, I'm going to take to be very much bigger than the generator of... Let's assume for simplicity that there only is one generator of the second cohomology. It's easy enough to generalize in the other cases. But well, actually, I could just say it's bigger than all the generators. When I expand it in terms of the coefficients of a positive sets of generators here, then all the coefficients are going to be much, much, much greater than 1. let's also assume that B is 0. Well, this is then equal to e to the ij the TOG class isn't going to matter because the TOG class doesn't start to contribute until four forms. It's one plus a two form plus a four form. I'm just going to consider the first two terms. So expanding out the chain character, I get the rank plus the first chain class of F, and the square root of the TOG class I'm going to ignore. That's going to be a higher correction. Well, this is equal to integral of x of minus 1 over 6 I r j cubed minus a half j squared c1, which is minus I r v minus a half d, where v is the volume of the Calabi-Yau and d is the integral of j squared times the first chain class. This implies that psi is 1 over the argument, sorry, minus 1 over pi times the argument, is minus 1 over pi times the inverse tangent of 2v over mu, where mu is d divided by r. Okay. Sorry? It's a number that depends on the Kähler form, as well as the first chain class dependent. Now consider zero goes to A, goes to B, goes to C, the vector bundles. So this first example, I'm not going to use the machinery of the derived category. That's going to come later on in the more complicated examples. This is just a simple example where I'm just going to stick to vector bundles. Well, this implies that the Chern character of B is the Chern character of A plus the Chern character of C, which implies that the central charge of B is the central charge of A plus the central charge of C, which implies that the phase of B lies between the phase of A and the phase of C. Now suppose I'm assuming... I'm assuming that I've chosen myself to be in the obvious range. It's lower order. It doesn't vanish. It's just that I've said that J is very, very big.
Lower in J.
In J, yeah.
So this is an approximate value
of C. Right. This is where J is much, much bigger than all the generators of the positive integer cohomology. I'm going to do things exactly next time. This is just the fun warm-up exercise. Now, suppose that mu of A is bigger than mu of B. Then that, of course, implies, from the formula over there, that psi of A is greater than psi of B, which implies that psi of my map, phi, is less than zero. Now, in any triangle, okay, so when I think of these A's as this A, B, and C as vector bundles, then I can write a short exact sequence. If I now move to the derived category, the best I can do is to put them in a triangle. So the triangle is going to look like this, say, where my plus one map here. That's the bit that loops back. Now, since going once around a triangle, is shift left, it must be true that if I were to add up the gradings of these maps, I must get one. This is the way that I identified the gradings with where I was in the complexes. Remember, that was what my definition of location in the complex was in the topological field theory. So since I've got to shift one operator every time I go around, adding up the grade of that, that, and that must correspond to plus one. But I've said that the grade of phi was less than zero. From the fact that the argument of B lies between the argument of A and B, sorry, the argument of B lies between A and C, that must imply that psi of beta is zero, which implies that psi of gamma is bigger than 1. Which implies, so I've got an edge of a triangle where the grading is bigger than 1, that implies that the opposite vertex is unstable. Sure, yeah. Yeah, that's an assumption that I'm making. I'm assuming that.
I just wonder, like, in general, we have this problem. How would you say, how would there be maintained a reasonable number? So why don't we have this problem in what we're
I'm really sweeping this issue under the rug because I think it can be a complete nightmare. So let me just assume that A is stable.
So A is not what exactly does it mean? What about what we mean? That all line models and the zero grading are stable?
Well, what I'm claiming is that I've shown that B is going to be unstable if there is a sub-bundle A. I mean, that's what an exact sequence going from A to B is. If there is a sub-bundle B such that this is true. So if that sub-bundle itself was stable, then it's going to work.
Well, we have to determine
somehow this process. All you've proved is that an unstable vector bundle gives an unstable
rank. Right, that's right. Right. Right.
But if
it isn't so bad if I'm just considering vector bundles because there's only so many sub-bundles you can look at. No, that's what I'm saying. I'm assuming that I'm only going to consider vector bundles. I agree. If you want me to be rigorous, I'm in deep trouble because I've got this problem of not knowing what I'm of not being able to characterize properly whether the things I'm looking into are stable or not. I freely admit that I'm really not worrying too much about that, and I should. But just if I just restrict myself to vector bundles, then these are the only possible.
Well, so the question was, is it fair to assume that we can assume that there are gradients, for example, that they're all stable vector bundles,
and
the older thing are stable gradients? Or when are you going to assume?
Well, if I assume that the I'm assuming that if the only thing I'm going to consider are vector bundles, then with that assumption, that the classical notion of things being stable, namely, there exists no sub-vector bundle A such that this is true, is exactly the same thing for being... I said vector bundles. I said I'm restricting myself to vector...
I mean, usually I'm used to be able to actually check it for sub-coherent sheaves, not just sub-vector.
Yeah, but you've gone to a more general case than I'm saying. No, I'm... Okay.
Stable vector bundle. You check it not just for sub-bundles, but for sub-sheaves.
Okay.
So that's exactly...
Yeah, I'm not saying I've dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's in this argument. I'm saying that you get exactly the same kind of inequality when you look at this distinguished triangle than you would have got from the classical notion of things being stable. Okay.
Assume, therefore, that all the larger radius limit. All the stable coherent
cubes,
they just check postulates
to be stable. Right, absolutely, yeah. Right. I mean, I'm never going to be able to solve this problem of having to worry about the things that I decay into being stable. But with certain assumptions, I will be able to make some statements about things being stable. Okay, so that's a good place to stop, and we'll do more examples next time. Thanks.